The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Vic Smith.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So you ever wonder how we got to an era where you've got a political party in this country who, with a straight face, goes to the American people, yeah, we're going to kick 24 million people off of health insurance so that we can give a massive tax break to the wildly wealthy. Did you ever wonder how it is we ended up in a scenario where states are telling school districts, sorry, we can't fund education because we need to give massive tax handouts to corporate America? Have you ever wondered how all that stuff happened and how it is that we've created the largest billionaire class in the history of civilization while simultaneously allowing what was one of the greatest infrastructures in the world to exist? You ever wonder how that happened? Well, a new book out, Kill It to Save It, An Autopsy of Capitalism's Triumph Over Democracy is out, written by Corey Dolgan. A book highly, highly suggest, which is why we've asked the author to come talk with us. Corey, thanks for taking time for us.
Sure, my pleasure, Rick.
You know, I keep coming back to this. How is it in my lifetime we've gone from we believe in, you know, infrastructure programs, we believe in education, we fund things that we as a society need, to a society that goes, no, we only want to give money to rich people?
Well, you know, the problem is you and I failed. I think that, grew up at a time when these kinds of institutional policies existed, these programs existed, and I think that we had a false sense of optimism after this movements of the 1960s and 70s, and I think, certainly for me anyway, you know, I felt that this was the way of the world. And I think a lot of the battles that were fought in the 60s and 70s about kind of rethinking what a progressive social welfare state should look like and could be were defeated by the new right. And what I argue in the book is that, you know, our hardwiring as a political country and a social country has been, you know, really rewired to believe in these myths about America and about who we are and how we work. And not only were the myths never true, that thus the myth, but in fact now they're fueling some of the worst kleptocracy and now fascism I think we've seen in many years.
Yeah, I mean, I keep asking, how did we go from the idea of, you know, rising tide lifts all boats to the hell with you, it's mine?
Right. Well, you know, part of it, of course, is you know, I talk about voodoo economics in the book, and really the notion somehow that the land of job creators will create great wealth and then share it with us by raising our wages and giving us better benefits has never been true. And certainly in the last 30 or 40 years, it's been less true than ever before. But we continue to believe in the, you know, the kind of second coming of the Reagan mythology that if we're only left alone to our own devices, free of all of the social welfare programs that in actuality created the middle class to begin with, but if we were somehow liberated from them, we could compete successfully based on our own hard work and acumen. And it just doesn't work that way.
And our exceptionalism, because we're wonderful.
Well, we love exceptionalism, don't we? Except when it makes us different than everybody else.
No, I love the idea of American exceptionalism, the idea that we're going to have a society where if you work hard, you play by the rules, you could actually get ahead, I grew up in that world believing. Today, you know, if I were growing up in today's world, I'd have to question that.
Absolutely. And, you know, I talk about it at the beginning of the book. You know, one of the real inspirations for the book has been watching my college students over the last 25 years go from a group of people that thought if they did moderately well and worked hard that they would, in fact, get ahead to, you know, one of the most anxious, stressed out, and paranoid generations. And the real change is not only what's happened economically, but also what's happened socially and culturally, because very few of these students see collective action as a form of social change. And so they continually blame themselves for their own failures and their own struggles and think if they just work even harder. But, you know, there's only so much any individual can actually work. And the fact of the matter was that people worked hard for many, many years and didn't get ahead, and they've been called slaves. And, you know, the hard work mythology that's part of our DNA has been pretty misconstrued from the get-go. And I would add also, there are people in France, and there are people in Canada, and there are people in Switzerland who work very hard and get ahead. And so the notion that somehow that was an American thing has also been a kind of misapprehension of our exceptionalism.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think? You know, I get this a lot from people, and you know, I love the idea. You know, just last week we talked about a living wage because the Georgia race brought that back up to the forefront. You've got people who look at other workers as if their work isn't as valuable and thus it shouldn't be rewarded at such a level. Look, I'm a labor guy, and I go back to the period in this country where we were fairly living in the same, you know, the same arena at least. Well, I don't know if we were even living on the same planet today when it comes to wealth inequality. You know, how is it that, you know, we got to this moment? I go back to the Reagan era and, you know, really the divisiveness that came out of that. But, you know, I'm again, you know, you're the expert. You're the guy who wrote the book on this. When do you think this all kind of came apart?
Well, I think that we can pretty much look at the post-World War I, and in some ways, you know, post-Depression, certainly the New Deal, as a moment in this country when we really started to take the social welfare state idea seriously. You could go back to mass public education even earlier, but these attempts to create kind of mass national systems that would build not just the infrastructure of highways and roads, although that's part of it, but also an infrastructure of education and healthcare. It's probably most articulated in Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights, which unfortunately never actually passed. But in that speech and in that idea was the notion of creating the national public infrastructure that would make us very similar to European countries and give us the kind of inalienable rights to, you know, to a good job, to education, to healthcare, and to not having to compete unfairly, not only with the rest of the world, but with one another.
Yeah, an actual right to work.
Exactly.
I mean, we hear a lot about right to work, and none of it gives you any rights. But, you know, an actual right to work, an actual right to a voice on the job, a right to a decent wage, a right to health care, retirement security, you know, actual rights instead of you're on your own, brother.
No, that's right. And I think you can see that that's one of the aspects of the defeat of this social welfare state has been the creation of this rhetoric, you know, whether it was Reagan's peacekeepers, you know, which were really some of the worst ICBM missiles ever created, Tomahawk missiles, rather, you know, to this notion of right to work, which is really Orwellian in the fact that it's exactly the opposite. You know, but that's really what part of Kill It to Save It is about, is that this movement to dismantle the public interest and the public sector and the public good has been fed to us within the language of freedom. The language of, as I call in the book, junk freedom. You know, this notion that somehow freedom is not about the ability to get an education or the ability to have a good job. It's really just about the ability to be free from government intrusion, unless you happen to be a woman who wants an abortion or a transgender person who wants to use the bathroom of their choice.
Right, and they also use the concept of TINA. There's no alternative. We have to do this. And I remember, you know, here in Pennsylvania in 2011. As they went to destroy the unemployment compensation insurance program,
right,
saying that, you know, we had a massive deficit, never mind the fact that, you know, employers hadn't been paying anything into it, you know, at all over the last 20 years and left it defunded from the beginning. But we have to have these draconian cuts. We have to, you know, have these massive increases and we have to cut the number of people who can get it because we're trying to save the program.
That's right. Yeah, that's Kill It to Save It in a nutshell. But, you know, I also want to make it clear, you know, this book was written primarily with the understanding and assumption that Hillary Clinton would be the next president. And so while I was able to finish the book after the election and correct a few parts, what's really clear and has been clear to me is that part of the reasons the Democrats lost is that they've been part of this program and, in fact, have been promoting kill it to save it policies as well.
Yep.
You know, so when we talk about, you know, why some of these programs have failed, and you mentioned TINA, you know, there is no alternative, as opposed to TIMBA, there must be a better way, a better alternative. You know, one of the advocates of TINA have been the neoliberal Democrats, the Clintonians, who essentially not only argued there is no alternative to neoliberalism, but also there's no alternative to the Democratic Party when it comes to progressives. And so I think that their triangulation strategy, you know, finally really came back to bite them. And I think that one of the best moments of this, you know, of this kind of chaos and fiasco that is American politics today is that we've really opened up some space for real progressives and left folks to be out there, not just organizing and demonstrating in the streets, but also constructing a new vision of what kind of country we want.
Right. Because here's the thing, and you know, I know a lot of my labor friends who voted for Donald Trump, you know, listen to the rhetoric.
Right.
And the rhetoric was, you know, a lot of what the labor movement had been telling their members. We want sane trade policies. We want to bring back manufacturing. It's the economy, stupid. And you know, this vision of we're going to bring back the 1950s where, you know, you can live on one income and everything's going to be great. And the Democrats, you know, couldn't take that ground because they were complicit in letting that stuff go.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I call it a paralysis in the book. No, I think you're absolutely right. Yeah, I have a section towards the end of the book called It's the Political Economy, Stupid. And, you know, it's really clear to me that, you know, labor, certainly, you know, the not the rank and file, but the bigger folks in labor and the business union folks of labor have also been part of the problem historically. And, you know, whether we go back to labor unions fighting for white privilege more than class unity, you know, to the contemporary aspects of unionism, who followed Donald Trump because, you know, they had to believe somebody. And the Democrats were no longer believable or credible when it came to class politics. In fact, the, you know, the, even this new analysis that the Democrats lost because they didn't pay enough attention to the white working class and were too invested in identity politics is a slight misreading and almost turning on its head of what the issues are. Because, yes, the Democrats have adopted this kind of boutique identity politics where it was always about marketing to a particular group here and a particular group there, instead of recognizing the kind of multiracial class politics they needed to articulate and what kind of policies that would require. And so if they now bend over backwards towards specifically a white working class, I think they're just going to make similar mistakes over and over again. We really need a much better multiracial sense of what class politics have to be about.
Yeah, but at the end of it, to me, it always comes back to the narrative. And Republicans do a much better job of telling stories, as where Democrats get, you know, just get wordy and off onto the off into the wherever they go. And it comes back down to that basic message. And you look at the New Deal. It was about making people's lives better. Didn't care if you're black, white, orange, purple. It was about making people's lives better. And at the end of it, the Democrats had better figure out how they no longer cater to Wall Street and to the super rich to stay politically viable with the money. But, you know, and I think Bernie Sanders showed how this can happen, but actually talking about how we make people's lives better.
I think that's absolutely right. But I do think we can't ignore that even the New Deal had its, you know, had its white supremacy, that certain programs helped some people more than others. And so I do think we can, you know, we can still be anti-racist and pro-working class. And we don't have to make decisions about whether or not, you know, do we come down hard on policies that are inherently unequal because they don't account for racial inequity. We can still consider those aspects as part of a class politics. We just have to be careful about trying to tell stories that are too simple. And I do think that's always been a problem with the Democrats, is that they will only tell stories that they think are marketable, whereas the Republicans actually take the time to generate the narrative to make sense with people. We need to be educative. We need to actually tell stories that are educational and true, but we can tell them in a way that will grasp people's needs and imagination.
Now, would you argue that the Democrats haven't done a very good job of building infrastructure and the echo chamber that the right has? Because, you know, to do what you're saying, you do need to have those vehicles to get to people.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, I mean, here you are, you have a show, and I think your show has an impact. And I think we need to do a much better job of that. You know, MSNBC started out as a kind of progressive news station, but pretty much became an echo chamber for the Democrats. And I think they've lost that. You know, we need a solid progressive left press that's not only about marketing, but it's also about narrative. And, you know, I was listening to the first hour of the show, and, you know, I want to thank you for having me on, and now I'm going to offer a critique. But, I mean, I think that the kind of all Russia all the time and the fascination with Trump is, it's important to bring down the thugs. But, you know, to my mind, Pence and Ryan and other folks are going to be even worse thugs.
I agree.
They may not be the gangsters that Trump is, but they're still thugs. And we need to really make sure that we're not just talking about Trump and the conspiracies and the scandals, but we're also looking at, you know, and I thought your correspondent in D.C. did a great job in fleshing out some of these other policies that are coming down. And what these new tax bills and what the new Trump care and all these other things are doing to really forward this kill it to save it mentality, and will leave us no public infrastructure. So we really need to make sure that we keep our eyes on the prize as far as that goes. Trump may come or go, but this struggle for some kind of social justice is still going to be there.
I'm with you. The attack on the 20th century continues. So. And it's what we're seeing right before our eyes, and it's nothing new. So, you know, the idea, as you were saying before, you know, that this last election, you know, all of those things that you brought up were not about just this last election.
That's right.
It's been the last several years.
That's right.
You go back to the foundation of the DLC and that whole push of being Republican light.
That's right.
So coming back to the book, you know, what are the marching orders for people? You know, how do we turn this around? How do we go from the Reagan era, ketchup is a vegetable, and slashing school funding and school lunch programs, to being that nation, you know, of making people's lives better?
I have no clue.
Honest, I love it.
But that is actually part of the answer, right? I have no clue. I don't have marching orders for people. I know what historically has worked, and in fact, I'm writing a book now called American Fascism. And while the argument is that we have fascism in our DNA from our origins, that we also have anti-fascism, and that there have been incredible strong social movements throughout our history that have changed the structure of our country for the better at some of the worst looking moments ever. And if you think about the history of the civil rights movement coming out of McCarthyism, you know, there are very dark moments in our country, and we come out of them sometimes in incredible ways. My best feeling right now comes when I watch thousands and thousands of people take to the streets, or even more notable, the airports. Can you imagine people going to some of the worst places in the world, U.S. airports, and spending hour upon hour, day after day, protesting the travel or Muslim ban from Trump? So people are responding in very productive ways by being out there in opposition. But I also think we need to be really active locally, because democracy starts in local communities. And if we can make the effort to get involved in local communities and local politics and then really translate them into larger and collective movements, the actual marching orders are going to come from those movements, not from anyone like me.
There you go. The correct answer to that question was read my book. Just to let you know.
I need marketing advice.
There you go. Again, Kill It to Save It, An Autopsy of Capitalism's Triumph Over Democracy, written by Corey Dolgan. We'll get a link at therickSmithShow.com of how you can pick it up. Corey, it was great talking with you. Love to have you back again real soon.
Oh, thank you, Rick. I'd love to come back.
Good stuff. Thanks so much. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Hear what I say.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.